welcome to class. Our penultimate lecture. Before we dive in, comments, thoughts, questions, other things for me? Yes?
I think the question on the quiz might be key or something like that.
Oh, that's possible.
There's two that select all that apply that has no correct answer.
I think there actually was one that had no correct answer, but I don't remember putting two of those. Let's see. Nope, it is not fixed. There are correct answers on 10.
11 and 12.
Oh yeah, I should have keyed those. Oh, I'll have to go back and key those. Oh, I don't remember where I did these questions. Let's see. Consider time performance of a filter function S, the number of elements, the filter's longest dimension, separable filters are asymptotically, constant factor not. They are asymptotically. That also shouldn't have been a select all that apply.
Yeah, they seem to be.
Clearly, I didn't finish writing these questions. And that adds up to exactly 100. Does this one add up to exactly 100?
No.
All right, space performance.
It's 102%.
Right, so the space performance is also asymptotic, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So,
This is less obvious. I remember drafting this and thinking, I need to come back and fix that question, and I never did. I may just drop that question.
It's
vaguely worded.
It said a function of S, which I was assuming all the other dimensions were treated as constant for some.
It's not a well worded question.
It's not asymptotic.
Well, so this is a.
As a function of S, it's not.
It's constant in its input size, right? It required neither separable nor non-separable require any space that wasn't provided in the problem definition. And so space efficiency here, I mean, yeah, we can argue about it, but it's really a weird question to ask, which is why I drafted and I thought, oh, I should change that. And then I apparently just got distracted and didn't. Because you don't need anything. If you have the filter and you have the image, that's all the space you need. Plus, you know, a few local variables. So I'll probably just end up dropping question 12. Yeah?
What about 11? Like, isn't it still like similar issue? Like,
I don't see an issue with 11.
Just like, so if you've given us like both side lengths as variables, then I feel like it would have been asymptotic, but isn't it still just like S plus whatever the constant is for the shorter side length versus S times that side length?
Only if the shorter side length is an asymptotic term smaller than the larger.
Yeah, and I assume that you would have given it to us if it wasn't.
Okay. I'm not seeing this. You're assuming that all of our filters are linear? Are lines?
Not lines, but like...
But if constant narrow? That they have no...
Well, yeah, because you didn't give us a variable like to describe the size of the other dimension.
Okay, I'm hearing what you're saying. I can't see that, but I'll need to think about that when I'm not on the spot and reflect on that. Yeah, okay, I'll ponder that. If you had checked both, I could see that. But if you check, anyway, all right, I'll revisit that idea at another time. Other questions? Yes.
So for the question about which of the following use a convolution filter?
I don't remember where that was. Where was that?
I think it was question 8.
Okay.
So for tone mapping, don't you usually use the gradient to determine?
Yeah, I should accept both answers for that. There are both techniques that do and don't for tone mapping.
Okay.
So I should have accepted both answers there. Thanks for catching that. I will forget that by the time I go back to my office. Could you email me telling me to fix that on the key? Thank you. Yes?
For that same question, I think I thought about shadow volumes possibly using something like a convolution filter in order to like compose two images together, but is that like...
That's not shadow volumes. That's shadow mapping.
But we originally talked about how Oh, I guess I'm just referring to stencil buffers.
The stencil buffers, oh, yeah, we don't convolve the stencil buffers because we're doing a, they're acting like binary fields.
Yeah.
Yeah. Other questions? Yeah?
Is the, what's your policy on late submissions of the product?
Yeah, so I was actually going back because somebody else asked this. When I was having new faculty orientation, they told us that we weren't allowed to accept any assignments after the last day of classes unless it was the final exam. And I can't find this written down anywhere, so I'm not sure. I still believe that's the policy I was oriented with, and so I'll keep looking and see if I find it. But if that's the case, then Friday midnight is the end. Yes?
If this means anything, compilers is accepting submissions a
week later. I know that many people ignore policies. I have never seen that as a reason to ignore policies. But if I can't find the policy, then maybe it was fiction. Yes?
There was a question about making on the quiz about hard shadows, and it did not accept shadow mapping. But if you made it slow enough by making your shadow map big enough, wouldn't it give you a hard shadow?
Except we explicitly said arbitrarily high resolution to get at that point, right? For any given scene, you can find a high enough resolution map, but you move somewhere and it no longer works. Yes?
About question six.
Yeah.
So I didn't choose circular shadow images because it's not like accurate, and I didn't see anything in the question to really, imply that like it was or wasn't supposed to be accurate, so I assumed it was supposed to be like an accurate shadow.
Okay. That's an interesting read. They have penumbras. I'm sorry? Other question? Yeah.
So with the way we do shadow mapping, don't we usually blur at the end, or when do we do the blurring part, and why can we not do that later for shadow volumes, for instance?
So the blurring in the shadow mapping happens in our understanding of the screen space image, right? And we don't have, the camera space image, right? You take a picture from the camera, we take a picture from the user, we can blur those together. And particularly, we actually don't blur the image. What we do is we say, we're going to check not just this pixel in the camera's picture, but all of the surrounding pixels. We don't have that notion for the shadow volumes. We just have a stencil buffer, so we only have a screen space. Could we blur in the screen space? Yes, but that would not create anything like a soft shadow. It would just create a blurry shadow. Other questions? All right. The end is in sight. Just some sort of administrative things. I do plan to write a quiz for this week so you know what the questions would be for your final. However, I also have to leave right after class on Thursday to go get in an airplane. So I might be a little late releasing the quiz. I've thought about various ways to deal with this. If I can get it done quickly enough, I may go ahead and release it then. If I can't get it done quickly, I may instead make it a non-credit quiz or drop an extra, I don't know, something. I haven't figured out exactly what to do, but just know there'll be something weird about the quiz that I release on Thursday. I do want questions about this week on your final, and I want it to consist of things from the quizzes, so it will be released, but it'll be a little odd. Yes?
What we do on Tuesday?
So if I can't get it out on Thursday, it probably won't be due on Tuesday. That's one thing I might deal with. I may just make it due before the final exam, and that will give me a little bit of flexibility. It may not come out until Monday if I don't get my act together, because I am flying to Atlanta for a very packed 2 days of talking to the National Science Foundation about money. I wish now I'd said no to that trip. Yes?
The quiz is due before the final exam. Is it meta submission that is
allowed? Yeah, that's right. That was specifically said assignments cannot be due. They actually had it anyway. But I found this in my orientation materials from 6 years ago. I just haven't found it written down anywhere. Yeah, besides there.
I was just going to say, can you make it so it's due at some point we can see the correct answers before the final?
Oh, yeah, that's probably a good idea. Probably making it due right before the final is the wrong thing to do.
During the final.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that I will have some time and I will get it out a little bit later than usual on Thursday or maybe on Friday, in which case I think still Tuesday is a fine deadline unless you all disagree. But I'm not 100% certain yet because there's a lot of unknowns in this schedule. This has been sort of a less than energetic way to begin a lecture. All right, let's talk about terrain and trees. We're actually going to start with trees, which if you, if you did any of the reading in advance, you would know none of them talk about trees. All right, trees. There's lots of things to say about trees, and we're only going to say just a tiny number of them. And we're going to start by talking about something that you probably shouldn't use, but everybody knows about, called the L system. Everybody's going to expect you to know that this can make trees. It can't, but it's a reasonable first basis, okay? The L system, also called the Lindenmayer system, because Lindenmayer created them, let's go ahead and look at it. I didn't think this was, I couldn't find a write-up that I thought was at the right level of detail, but we'll still go here, okay? So this is a rewriting system. You have a type of formal grammar. Okay, this is literally a context-free grammar for creating branching things, or a family of context-free grammars for creating branching things. So, what's the idea? The idea is you have a set of variables, an axiom, that's your start state in your grammar, and then a set of rules, productions. Okay. However, these are designed so that the rules are typically unambiguous. So you only have one production from each non-terminal. And so the idea is you just keep rewriting it over and over again. And you end up with strings like this. And you're like, okay, why did we care? Now, the reason we care is because we then give a meaning to each of the steps. Okay, so we can do this, and then we can decide what they all mean. All right, so, here they have this example. Again, not a hugely great example, but they have this example where you have square brackets, ones, and zeros. And then they say if it's a zero, draw a line segment. If it's a winding in a leaf, if it's one, draw a line segment. If it's a square bracket or a square bracket, push and turn. Okay, you just come up with these terms for doing it, and then when you go through it, and they do have some pictures that are, you know, sort of okay, you end up with this sort of basic branching fractal tree. L systems are a fairly early effort to say, ooh, we can use math and computers to represent nature. And it turns out that they fail to represent nature in a couple of really important characteristics. One is that they're completely regular. Right? And so then people have added into them, like, turn a random amount and so on. There's lots of variations you can try to put in them to make them better for doing different things. They can do all kinds of different fractals, right? But for example, if you take this particular picture, this is one that made people think, oh, you really can do cool things with it, and you can if you use 6. Right? But if you use 5, it looks skeletal, and if you get up to 7, you start noticing, oh, this is just the same thing over and over again. And anyway, and so, right, you have these systems, and some people spend significant effort coming up with things, and there's actually an entire article about the Barnsley fern, right? And Barnsley came up with lots of these fern-like things that you can do, and you know, there's some interesting things going on here. But they have this sort of mathematical self-similarity. The other thing that trees don't actually have is they aren't scale independent, right? Just for an example, let's look at an actual image of a fern. We'll compare it to the Barnsley fern. This is going to be, I don't know, obvious, but we're going to do it anyway. Okay? It is true that ferns have leaves that seem to be made out of leaves that are lumpy. But not leaves, they're made of 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 leaves, like a fractal, right? You can get some cool things at some sort of low resolution, but at some point it tends to sort of end, OK? Okay. Now, these are still used a fair amount for various purposes of making the bulk branching structure. You can have them parameterized. They do different things as they get farther along. And there are different kinds of ferns that go like one extra step. And so, you know, they're better at making some kinds of plants than others. But in the end, there's a limit to how much they can do. Now, of course, if you just continue making your grammars more complicated, like context-sensitive grammars, from computational theory, what do you use context-sensitive grammars for? That's right, nothing. They're too complicated to solve. Right? So we can do things to make them more powerful, and eventually we can end up with a programming language. And then we can do whatever we want. And so a lot of this space is trying to add in just enough cool things that our rewrite system gives us cool ideas, but not too much. And they do work pretty well, right? Like, they have these examples in the front of various L systems used to make different kinds of treeing structures. And these are a nice baseline to sort of say, oh, we're going to populate our scene with a few of these trees. They involve some amount of, we have a branching for a while, and then we change to a leafing, right? Some amount of sort of heuristics to make them work. But they can give us some nice baseline models. Part of the reason I don't spend a lot of time talking about this is I don't know a whole lot to say about them. I have spent more time than I care to recount playing with L systems and having classes about L systems. I took an entire course on how to draw trees and landscapes. Anyway, and at the end, I realized that it's pseudo magic. It's you tweak with the parameters until it looks right, or you look at a real plant and say, okay, I guess we need to do a 45 degree branch now. And it wasn't clear to me that there was a great deal of insight that arrived from it. So we're going to talk, you're welcome to look into this. It has a fairly low barrier of entry. You can get going pretty quickly if you want to play in this space, and it has a high upper limit of where you could go. So it certainly has some value. But some things to understand about trees beyond L systems is really where we want to spend the portion of our day that's going to be talking about trees. Okay, so we're going to talk today about the golden angle, about the conservation of cross section, and we're going to talk about reification. And that's probably all we will say about this, because we just have half a day to talk about this. I think that's right. Anyway. All right. So let's start with the golden angle. And to do this, let's find ourselves a picture of a sunflower. Okay. Of course, you have to pick them at exactly the right time to see the point we want to get across. Here we are. All right, here's a picture of a sunflower. What do you notice about the central area here? Patterns you see. I heard somebody say Fibonacci. What? How do you see it? Or did somebody just tell you it was there? Oh, it says it right here. Yeah, okay, clearly. You saw it written down. But where is it? What do we mean when we say Fibonacci? All right, so we're just going to go just a tiny bit down into some very basic number theory to understand what's going on here. All right. The golden angle is based on the golden ratio, which is the least rational number. What do we mean by the least rational number? So, rational numbers can be represented by the ratio of some small integers, right? And the bigger your integers have to get a good approximation, the less rational it is, okay? In a hand-wavy way. Now, there are things that need an infinitely large numerator and denominator to have a good representation. But we can deal with how rational it is based on how many digits in the numerator and denominator you need to get in order to get a certain number of digits of precision. And the least rational possible number is 1 plus 1 over 1 plus 1 over 1 plus 1 over 1 plus 1 over, etc. Okay? And there's a whole system of continued fractions and how you prove these things and how you derive them and anyway. But this is as bad as you can get. This is a number that you just can't get any better than this. And if you take a truncated versions of this, you will find this fraction is the ratio of adjacent Fibonacci numbers. Okay? So you truncate in any given point in time and you've got 3 over 2 or 5 over 3 or 8 over 5 or 13 over 8. Right, you always have some Fibonacci n divided by Fibonacci n minus 1. This is the least rational number. Why do we care? If we were ancient Greeks, we would care because we believe that numbers have the power to control our eternal destiny, and we would set up temples about them. We aren't, mostly. So there's other reasons we care about this. In particular, I talk about the angle. This is a number, it's not an angle, okay? But if we take this particular number, which is often called phi, which is 1.61 something, right? We can solve it all out. It can be represented, one of my favorite ways of representing it is 0.5 times 0.5 to the 0.5 plus 0.5. Anyway, there's all kinds of like cool little ways of writing it that people think, right. Anyway, there's different ways of writing this number. But this number, if we take this number modulo 1, so if we take this number modulo 1 and get just the remainder, and we keep adding to itself modulo 1, we have this interesting property that on our number line, right, so our first one's going to arrive somewhere at 0.6. Then we add 0.61 to itself, we get something that's going to arrive over here, rounding that around 0.2, and then around 0.8, and then and so on. But we're going to keep adding a little bit. And the rule is every single new point will arrive at the largest contiguous unvisited region. So as you keep going, you end up with everything always ends up in the biggest region, and it never cuts it in half. It always leaves a bigger and a smaller region so that there will always be an unambiguous biggest region later. Okay? And so if we put this around a circle, okay, we start somewhere and we go somewhere else, and then we go into the bigger region, and then we go into the bigger region, and then we go into the bigger region, and however this works, and we always just put ourselves in the biggest unopened region. And this behavior has a very nice property when it comes to things like where should we put the next seed as our sunflower grows? Okay? Sunflowers, conceptually, don't know how big they're going to get. If it's a good year, they get bigger. So they start with some and they need to add more. Okay? And similarly, trees don't know how many branches they're going to get. And pine cones don't know how many pieces they're going to get. Lots of growing things want to have some sort of circular thing where we don't know how many we're going to get in advance. And so we want to put something in a place which will be far away from everybody else so we don't have to get too big too fast. Or if we think about looking top down at a tree, right? Here is the trunk. There is where we put the first branch. Where should we put the second branch? Well, if we put it directly opposite, then we're gonna get lopsided on branch 3. We don't wanna put it too close or they'll catch the same sun. So we're gonna put it off here at this special angle to leave a big and a small area. And then the next one will go in there, and the next one will go in there, and the next one will go in there, and the next one will go in there. And if we pick the right angle, all of them will lie in the biggest unopened space. And so if we only get to 3 branches, we got a pretty good collection of sun. If you get to 7,000 branches, we got a really, really good collection of sun. We're never sitting directly on top of each other. Everything is beautiful. Okay? And so this is the optimal arrangement for seeds in a circle, for branches around a tree, for pieces around the boundary of a cone, anything that's round and we need to put things around it. This is the angle to use. Yes?
How do plants make this calculation?
It's built in to their genetics. Yeah, they aren't good at not making it. Yes?
Can you just go over like how you get the angle?
Okay. Yeah, yeah. The angle is a circle times the golden ratio modulo a circle. OK? Okay? And you just go that many degrees or radians every time. Yes?
Is it, and then, like, times some integer?
Yeah, so then each subsequent one will be times the number of this particular element.
So, like, is this the best way, given the rule that you have to turn a certain angle, or is it just the best rule if you can take any arbitrary angle?
This creates, if you pick any arbitrary angle. If you know how many things you're going to have in advance, there are better packings. But if you don't, this is the optimal. Okay? So over all possible numbers you will stop at, this pattern will have the best, the most circular packing of the things around the circle and so on. Yeah. So this thing, it just exists. Now, it turns out, this is a random aside for those that like math, there isn't really a direct parallel in higher dimensions. So this beautiful pattern of I have this wrapping number line and I can always find the biggest region, this gives what's called a low disparity sequence, which are very useful for various numerical sampling techniques. And if you try to do it in 2D instead of 1D, there just isn't one. So we have various approximations to them, often using things like the remainders of Boolean polynomials and things to try to get like quasi-random distributions. But anyway, in 1D it just exists. Ta-da! And then plants use it for going around circles to make things work. Okay. So how would we find a particular seed around this circle? Okay. So if we take this, let's just call that theta. Okay, so I know that my angle for any particular seed, so seed n, where will it be? Its angle will be n times theta. So that's going to be its angle. And then its radius is going to be the square root of n. And so in polar coordinates, I go around and around and around and around and around and around and around, and I pick some point, right? And so my r, my radius, is going to be the square root of how many I have. The angle is going to be this. And you can place them optimally. Okay? You can also grow from the middle. So these also have this nice property. I had a demo for this, but I don't remember. I think I left it on my other computer. They have this nice property that if you just take every single seed and push it straight out, you can put them in the middle instead. And it will still remain perfectly packed as they go out, because no two seeds are on the same line. And so this just works very well for plants, and so it shows up all the time. Okay? And so when you're taking your L system and you're making it 3D, you almost always have this and go phi around every time to find the new branching plane. Okay? Because that's how most trees branch, except the sun, right? So this is how they would do it if you had this perfect environment where the sunlight comes from above and they're perfectly healthy and there's no wind, and right, in the real world is never that clean. But it's still, it's built into their genetics of almost all plants that have some sort of branching behavior to do this, and so simulating it is a useful thing to do. As a random aside, if you ever want to make something that looks sort of natural but not really, there is the second least rational number, which is not very close to the least rational number. And if you use that instead, you get these weird, like, bolded spirals. Anyway, number theory plus nature creates odd effects. But yeah. So, golden angle. Questions about golden angle? All right, conservation of cross-section. This is not true of all kinds of plants. But some kinds of plants, in particular many deciduous woody trees, if we think about our plant sitting here and it's got branches and so on, and it's branching out and eventually it ends up in some foliage. Hooray! Okay? Given that I know how fat this trunk is, how fat should these two branches be? And this turns out to be fairly easily answered for vascular plants. So many plants are dominated by having, they're basically just a big bundle of tubes, right? Their goal is to get water out of the ground and into the leaves so that it can evaporate and turn into sugar. And so it's just a giant bundle of tubes. And so if it's a giant bundle of tubes, the cross-sectional area here needs to be the sum of those two cross-sectional areas. Now, they aren't perfectly a bundle of tubes. Bark is like a protective outer layer that tends to be more or less uniform thickness, although it gets a little thinner later on, and the core wood's a little bit different, but it's a pretty good estimate. You want to make sure that the two branching tubes have the same cross-sectional area as the tube they branch into. And so this can help you figure out how much should they get thinner, however you pick your branching. It is also generally the case that many kinds of deciduous trees, many types of branching trees generally, I guess, they will typically have, and sometimes they'll just send out twigs, but often they'll have sort of a main branch and a minor branch, and they'll both change angles. It is generally the case that the more straight it is, the more of the area it gets. There's various explanations for this. But in general, there is a direct relationship between straightness and thickness for any given branching point. And so you can use this to further make your tree look realistic. So we have these different sort of heuristics that are based on understandings of nature that can help us make our L system or any other branching system we decide look more real. And then we have reification, which is how things actually work. All right. Before you go to reification, any questions about these two ideas? Yes?
So the cross-sectional area mm-hmm. is conserved?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, conservation of cross-sectional area, I should say. Yep. Other questions? Yeah?
Does the conservation kind of fall apart at like the bottom of the tree where it like spreads out?
Yeah, so it's not perfect. Although, if you try looking at the bottom of a tree after it comes out of the ground, you often see that it actually was preserved there and just there was gaps of the roots. And the roots actually start a little above the ground. Although that varies a lot by tree variety. And there are definitely trees that violate this. Most of the trees in this part of the world observe it. I don't remember if I know how to spell the baobab. Nope, not.
Baobab.
B-A-B. O-A?
Sorry, B-O-A-B-A-B.
Oh. Ah, here we go, right? We have these trees. To most people that didn't grow up with them, they look weird, right? Why do they look weird? What's weird about them? Well, they aren't growing like the trees we're used to. Their trunk has a different purpose. Now, they're still, you'll notice that still, like, area doesn't just vanish. But it quickly tapers. It got this strong tapering inside the branches, okay? And that's because this trunk in here is this big spongy water holder, okay? To get even farther away from this, if we go to a saguaro cactus, right, we get these things. These do it the wrong way, right? Every time they branch, they get fatter. Again, they aren't just tubes, right? They have something else going on. They're storing water, they have extra kinds of wax manufacture and so on. So when the trees do more than trees in sort of temperate branchy regions do, you'll get different kinds of behaviors. And sometimes in film and so on, people want you to figure out how to make it look alien. And so often that involves first understanding what the rules are and then violating a few of them in the right way to make it look strange. And that's often a big part of natural phenomena. You need to understand how it would work in the way your audience expects so that you know how to tweak that to make it seem strange. Other questions about these ideas? All right. Let's talk a little about reification. This is actually a very niche word, but it gets across an idea I think many of us don't understand. So let's talk a little about topiary. I've realized that there are people that don't know what topiary is. Topiary is not a natural phenomena, just in case you wondered. It's things like this. Where you take a bush and you carve it into animals or things. Okay? And the way you do this is, this isn't particularly complicated. You just, every year, you just cut off all of the branches that are going outside the area you want them to be in. There's a little bit more to it than that, because sometimes branches get big and you need to cut them a little farther back, right? There's a little bit of an art to this, quite a bit of an art to this. But the basic concept is you just chop the stuff that's where you don't want it to be over and over again over many years. And eventually it will grow into this shape. I wonder if we have a, if you ever see one of these that like falls apart in, nope, okay. That falls apart in some way. Nope, we don't have any. Oh yeah, here we go. Right? This is what they actually grow like. You keep chopping them, they keep growing. All their branches get all tangled up inside, not everything's around the edge. This is actually very useful. There are various agricultural societies. England was known for using hedgerows instead of fences. You do this over the years and it becomes virtually impossible for anything larger than a canary to get through it. And so you don't need to worry about other ways of keeping things through it, right? And so, right, this is what's going on. And you can, there are some plants that do this better than others, but many kinds of plants will do this if you keep chopping them. And so to understand sort of a little bit about what's happening here, there's this notion that the growing root, growing part of a tree, it typically has a number of little growing buds. Exactly how these work varies a little bit, but typically sort of with the golden angle around the branch, there'll be a little bud that could grow into a branch or a leaf or any or fruit or different things. Some trees have different kinds for different varieties, others don't. And typically we just keep growing from the tip. Getting away from the rest of the tree is usually a good strategy because we like light. Okay? And so typically we grow from the tip. There's various things that will make us stop growing from the tip. Eventually, falling down will do that. Or not getting enough fluid. But for topiary, what we do is scissors make us stop doing that. Okay? We chop it. And the basic attitude of the tree, there are some variations on it, but it will typically, the growth will reify, meaning it will go back to the last node and it will pick up from there. Okay, and it will start growing this direction until we chop it again. And then we'll go back to this one and we chop that. And it will go back to this one and we chop that. And eventually we can get it to say, ah, that was the last one available. It does essentially a depth first growth. Okay? This is not always the case, but many kinds of plants exhibit this behavior. Question? It depth first.
Like which angle?
Oh, so each of these nodes is placed on it at an angle, typically a phi spiral around the main shoot. Although sometimes gravity changes how that works, right? So sometimes if it's growing horizontally, they're basically just on the two sides, or occasionally up. But in general, a phi spiral is what's sort of genetically in most plants about where these nodes appear. And different kinds of plants will grow them at slightly different distances and so on. And different angles, and that will change to some degree how readily they will topiaryify. I don't think that's a verb. Anyway, but this is a basic principle of what's happening here. So there are, so you can use this to make computer-generated topiary. Nope. CG was not sufficiently expressive. Nope. Wow. Okay. Well, yes, but no. Computer, that's the backwards. That's a topiary of computer generated instead of computer generated topiary. Let's see if SIGGRAPH will help us out here because, you know, that's where a lot of these papers end up. Nope. Oh, yeah, well, this is from their paper. No, that's not great. Huh. Okay, well, I guess I should have prepared for this. I'm not seeing it here. Anyway, there are several papers have been published where they basically just said, hey, we did depth first searching for the next place to grow, and it works like real plants, and here's papers from biology that say that's how it works, right? And there are some other things you have to deal with, right? Every time when growth happens, typically there's, because we have this conservation cross-sectional area, typically there's a little bit more volume along the way, and some behaviors change, some of these buds will die, right? You can find out all of these things from biologists, and then you can put them in your code. Many of these rules are fairly straightforward, okay? Their combinations are not. Part of the interest of real trees is because the world happened to them while they were growing. It's because they grow so slowly that they end up being interesting. And so simulating that means you need to simulate random high-speed events occurring, right? Just like this branch falls off and, oh, there was a strong wind and this root popped, and right, whatever it is. And the more of those things you do, the more interesting your trees will get once you simulate their basic behaviors. So we could do L systems and just say it's a fractal. It's fast, it's easy. If people aren't going to pay a lot of attention to it, it'll work great. The actual simulation about what's going on, once we have the right parameters, a couple depth first searches, a little bit of math, and we're good there too. There's a whole lot more that there's, if you want really, truly great trees and plants and so on, there's more to understand. But a lot of it you can make decent enough for background, which is usually where plants end up in CG, without a whole lot of effort. Yes?
So on the other slide thing you were just on with the L system, yep. Are these ideas under the umbrella of L?
Oh, no, sorry. I should not have made that look like. Nope, that didn't help. All right. Nope. Ah, my slide's just getting worse and worse. There are different ideas. Ugh. One, two. No, these are just. I took an entire graduate course on plants, and I decided these were the ideas that were probably the big things to keep in mind if you decide to go down this route. There's a lot to be said about where do plants exist, and how do you locate plants in the environment, and anyway, we may come back to some of that. There's a lot that can be said, but we only had half a day, so I tried to hit some highlights that will allow you, if you want to jump off reasonably well. All right. Any more questions about plants before we dive into terrain? Yes?
Wait, so what exactly is reification?
Reification is the idea that when you chop it off, it goes back to the last node. The depth firstness.
In the topiary is then just an unnatural?
Topiary is the name of chopping trees into weird shapes. An ancient art. Other questions? Yes?
You might be about to talk about this, but what if you want to render a lot of trees?
You mean like render them as they grow?
Just like the whole forest full of trees.
Oh, what if you want to render a lot of trees? Yeah, Okay, you tell me. We've talked about various ways of rendering lots of things along the way. What are some ideas that would work?
Tweening.
So tweening is how you get from one animation frame to the next.
No, the other one, the background texture thing.
The parallax, right? So we can have different pictures of trees at different depths. Often, right, one of the ways you can do it is you can just say, my forest is made out of a picture of a tree, a picture of a tree, a picture of a tree, and then just twist them to face the camera. Okay? If I add a bump map to that or a normal map to that, I can make them look like they're lit. If I have 20 pictures and pick them at random, if you don't look too long, you won't even notice that I didn't have 1,000. Yeah?
Some games you can run through the trees. That wouldn't necessarily work.
Right. And so often what you want to do as any sort of, I have a huge amount of detail, I guess we haven't talked a lot about this, this often matters for outdoor scenes. There's so much detail, we can't render it all. So we want to have some way of having adaptive resolution. So I'll have the billboard model. And then often we will have a group of intersecting billboards model so that it can be seen from different areas and make some better shadows. And then we will have the okay, we're going to make a few like pictures of foliage and we're going to scatter them around and then have a physical model of a trunk. And then we'll have a higher resolution version of that, and then we'll have an actual tree model. And as you approach it, we want it to get to higher resolution. Now the jumping, the popping that occurs as we go from one of these to another is generally noticeable. And so often we'll try to set up the environment so that some trees are close to you and some trees are far away, and you can't fix that. You can't approach random trees in the distance. Or if you do, something gets in your way, so we can poof, change the geometry, right? There's various tricks to hide the jumps. Because there isn't an obvious gradation between it's a billboard and it's two billboards. I guess you have the billboards like fold out from each other to make it smooth, but you might notice that movement, because movement is easier to see than other things, right? You can make the ones that were parallel to the camera initially start transparent and make them more opaque, right? There are things you can do to try to make the transition smooth. But often those involve something changing in the scene which people notice. So you often just pick the right resolution for the distance you expect it to be at and hope that it's good enough. Other questions? Oh, and what's better than, right, what do you do in the distance? You just make a picture of trees. And you pick another picture of trees behind it to get that sort of parallax images effect, right? And then you have one that's just the rest of the scene. So you just keep reducing geometry, switching into images as you go. Other questions before we get to terrain? All right. So I started trees by saying, hey, there's these L system fractals and they don't really work. Let's do the same thing now. Fractal landscapes. Okay. The idea of a fractal landscape, you have this little animation, which I thought was all right. We turn a triangle into four triangles and just move them at random a bit. And we do that to each of those other triangles, and eventually we get something that looks lumpy. Terrain looks lumpy when, okay. There's a bit more to it than this, but this is a lot of the idea here, okay? And we've gotten pretty sophisticated at these, figuring out more and more about what's going on. But this is a basic idea of a lot of procedural landscape generation. Make a fractal. Make a statistically self-similar area. We have not talked about fractals yet in any detail, have we? All right, let's define fractal. Fractal. Fractal is a contraction of fractional dimension, which doesn't really work. But that's how they say, okay? So what do we mean by fractional dimension? This is this complicated mathematical space. And to understand a little about fractional dimension, let's look at, actually, we could probably do this. I believe there is a Wikipedia article about this. Yes. All right. That's not the one we want. Oh, nope, this was not the article I hoped it was. Hausdorff dimension, maybe that will give it for us. Yeah, all right, let's look at this one. Okay, if we continue replacing every edge with a triangle on the edge forever, how long is the edge? How much longer is the boundary of this than the boundary of that? So every 3 turns into 4. So it's 4/3 as big. And in this one, every 3 turns into 4. So this is 4/3 the size of this one. And this one is 4/3 the size of that one. Okay? And if we continue this forever, how long is the boundary? Infinite. It's 4 to the infinite divided by 3 to the infinite, which is infinite. Okay? How can you have a finite area with infinite boundary? What does that even mean? Okay, this is the idea that starts us out at thinking about Hausdorff dimension. You can get weirder things than this, right? You have this Sierpinski triangle where every triangle is replaced by a Sierpinski triangle. or four of them, depending, or three of them, depending on your perspective. And you can say, well, how much of the area does this cover up, right? And there's other things like this. We have also, let's get to the one that really gets us to the idea of this space dimension thing. If we go to, okay. If we go to a space-filling curve, so there's these things called space-filling curves. Here's the Peano curve. Peano curve takes an S, and notices an S goes from point to point and uses that to go from point to point in the S. Okay? In the end, if I continued this forever, what dimension would we say is the resulting picture? It fills every point in a two-dimensional space, right? The dimension of the Peano curve is two. It's a two-dimensional thing. It fills every point in space. There are others. There's the Hilbert curve and the Cantor curve, right? So this is the Hilbert curve, right? As we continue, it just turns into everything in space. And these are interesting because it gives us this baseline to say, okay, what is the dimensionality of something? How can a one-dimensional thing fill two-dimensional space? And so we have this idea of fractional dimension. This fills everything where that snowflake only fills 4/3 of things. And we have different kinds of ideas of fractional dimension. Conceptually, though, fractional dimension, the bigger it is, the bumpier it is. Okay, so it just gives us a single number that talks about the bumpiness of things. And not everything is the same amount of bumpy. So when we deal with, for example, if we take these two images here, we have a simulation of one terrain and a simulation of another terrain. They're both supposed to be mountains. These ones are bumpier than that. Okay, and in general, new mountains are bumpier than old mountains. And we can actually, there have been efforts to measure the fractional dimension of different mountain ranges. The Appalachians have one of the lowest fractional dimensions of any known mountain range. Anyway, right? We can just measure it. You can go out and say, oh, the Rocky Mountains, their Rockies are like 2.4, where the Appalachians are 2.12, or whatever it is. I don't know the numbers, right? But somebody can come out and do this. And once you know that, once you have this representation of how bumpy mountains are, you can then use that to generate your fractals. So this particular type of fractal is actually easier to think about in 2D, or 1D rather, okay? It's a very simple process. We connect two points. We find the midpoint. We perturb it randomly. How big a random number? It's a random number proportional to the length that separates them. So we're going to pick a fairly, we'll pick some deviation here, and we'll pick our new point. Now we have two points instead of one. And each of these will do the same thing. But they will have less perturbation because they're perturbation off of a shorter line. And we just continue until we have as many points as we want. Okay? And this will end up with a fractal. It'll end up something that's stochastically rather than exactly self-similar. Okay, you can zoom in on any part and you'll see more of the same. It will have similar visual character. And so we can do this to create a landscape. Now, 2D isn't a great way of doing that. So there's this algorithm for doing it if we want to do a surface. The diamond square is the most popular of these. Here's the idea. I pick a random location for the corners. I use them to find the middle. I randomly offset it. I now have diamonds, so I use those to find the center of the diamonds. I randomly offset them. Now I'm back to having squares, so I go to the middle of the squares. I randomly offset them. Now I'm back to having diamonds, so I go to the middle of the diamonds to get back to squares. So we can go sort of back and forth. At any given point, we find the average of 4 points to get ourselves new points, and we sort of rotate the grid 45 degrees. And every one of these points that we sample, we randomly offset. Okay? And we end up with things that look like this. Tell me why you don't want to use this image for your terrain. If this is a height map, if white is high and black is low, why does this not look like real terrain?
There's a crater.
Sorry?
There's almost a crater.
There's all these like depressions. This landscape doesn't drain. What else?
It's not like it's only local. There's no like if it's a mountain range, you want like a range, not like random.
Yeah, it's completely. There's no global behavior. There's no ranges. There's no tectonics. Yeah.
You can see the squares.
You can see the squares. Right? If I rotate this 45 degrees, you will know I did. Because we have these horizontal and vertical bits. They're an artifact of how we created the terrain. Okay? And so we have these problems with this kind of approach. It's very fast. It's very efficient. And we can do it at arbitrary scale. It's all local. We don't have to worry about long-term things. But it just doesn't quite work. It's the basis of a lot of random terrain generations. And there's lots of variations on it. So if you want to make one of these that doesn't have the square characteristic, you can go to Simplex Noise Demystified, which goes at some length into talking about how you can make something that's a little bit better and actually has like long commented code. Okay, why did I link to this? So this only gives you sort of essentially one octave of noise. It doesn't give you full bumpiness, but you can apply it on top of itself at another layer. Okay, but it gets rid of the axial characteristics, which is a nice thing to get rid of for various reasons. It means that you can't tell what direction was north or up or whatever when you're working on it. It involves quite a lot of little math. And the actual algorithm's write-up is typically quite messy. So I click to something that is trying to explain it. But often the first step of terrain generation is we generate a fractal with the right fractal dimension for this height map of our field. And then we add the other stuff. Let's think, for example, about erosion. Hopefully you're familiar with the idea of erosion. In earth science, erosion is the active surface processes, water flow or wind, removing soil or rock. Okay? It ends up with all kinds of weird things. Arches are created by thermal erosion, you have sea erosion, and so on. But one of the main things it does is it gives you ridges. Usually not this sharp, but you end up with ridges. The things that are high have less water flowing over them, and so they don't erode as fast as the things that are low. Because the water that hits the high parts rolls down into the low parts, and so does all the other water. And so the deep parts get deeper. And the high parts get higher, and you end up with an eroded landscape. It can be extreme like that. It can be less extreme like we're more used to, probably. Something like this. Right? Although we don't have this exact kind of landscape. That's up in Scotland, I believe. Yeah. Right? So we have this kind of behavior where anything you look at, you have erosion. You have a landscape that drains. The peaks are steeper than the pits and so on. You have these kinds of behaviors. So one of the simpler ways to create a fractal landscape is you generate your fractal. And then you say, okay, now I'm going to erode it. To do proper erosion requires fluid simulation and foliage simulation and mineralogy. We rarely do them all. We often just do a much simpler approach. We often just say, let's put a little bit of water everywhere. It rained. There's water everywhere. Okay? And we're going to say, water will pick up some soil wherever it is, and then it will flow downhill. So we'll have, all right, this water is going to flow downhill. And it's going to take some soil with it. All of the water in the scene is going to flow downhill, and it's all going to flow down into here, and it's all going to bring soil. And then we'll say if there's a lot of soil, some of it stops. It drops as alluvium, or dirt, right? And so we'll tend to fill up the low areas and carve away the high areas. And to make this work better, you then say, and the faster the water flows, the more soil it picks up. And the slower it flows, the more it drops. So it tends to erode more steep areas and deposit more in shallow areas. And you could just fill the thing with water, let it drain. Fill the thing with water, let it drain. Fill the thing with water, let it drain, until you end up with things that look like nice little mountains. You could do better than this, though. Okay? It needs to drain. What is a characteristic of landscape that drains? This means there's always a downhill. Okay, so you can take your random fractal. Let's go back to our random fractal. I didn't keep it up, did I? Nope. All right, let's go back to our random fractal that we got with our diamond square. If we say that white is high and black is low, we take any point that's darker than everything around it, and we just move it up to its nearest neighbor. So we just take everything that's darker than all of its neighbors and make it as dark as its darkest neighbor. And we do this over and over again until everything has something lower than it. Of course, that would just make everything flat. So we pick some boundary, some outlet that's allowed to be lower than everything else. Say, okay, this is the bottom of the lake. It can be a drain. This is the edge. It can go down into the sea. Everything else has to drain to one of those places. Okay? And so we can do a first pass to create a terrain that drains. And then our water simulations of additional erosion will go more efficiently. In practice, actually, a lot of the draining approximations will actually, they'll add instead of subtracting, right? Real hydrology moves things away from the tops of land, but we'll have it move up instead because it tends to be a little easier to move up than to move down in practice. So we don't know which of the neighbors needs to go down, but we do know which one needs to come up. And so we can do this to try to create terrain. There's a lot more we could say about terrain. If you've taken a geology class, you'll realize that the Earth is complicated. I have almost never seen a real effort to try to simulate it. Yeah?
It seems like this only deals with like water erosion, wind erosion.
Yeah. So how does wind erosion work?
Wind blows and takes things away.
Yeah. Wind turns out to primarily make, it turns out that thermal erosion is generally larger than wind erosion. And basically, thermal erosion, heat means pointy things become soft. Okay? So in general, heat and cooling cause things to expand and contract, which makes them brittle over time. The amount of change you get in heat is bigger if you are at a tip and you have less other things to absorb the temperature. So in general, sharp things will go away. You tend to see more of this in dry areas. Water is dramatically more effective at eroding rock than is... okay, I have so many tabs open. All right. So if we look for, I don't know, let's look for hoodoos. Yeah. Let's see. Oh, so here's a hoodoo. I did my undergrad in Utah. These things were really weird to me. I never really got used to them. These things just exist. You can come to like places where you, like Goblin Valley, you can get in the middle of it and you see nothing but these things all around. What's going on here? First off, no sharp edges. Everything is round. Sharp edges erode. But also the land was deposited in layers. It's all sandstone. Everything is rock here. It's perfectly solid. Even though to me, when I got there, it just looked like big piles of dirt. It's not. It's rock, right? But some layers were less solid than others. And so the rate at which it will erode there is higher. Okay? And then you have down here, you have scree. When it erodes, it will fall down on the ground. And that will prevent, it'll be a sort of an insulating layer. As you'll actually have this, it looks like a heap of dirt, but it's actually, there's a little bit of dirt on top of the rock, so the rock never eroded. And so you'll get these sort of wide bases. The scree is on top of it, and then you get this base around it, and you end up with these things, goblins and hoodoos and tifoni. Anyway, there's so many of these different things. There are weirder things than this, though. Stone is such a strange material. All right, let's look for tifoni. Yeah, this is rock. Naturally occurring rock. Okay? This is caused by seawater containing salt that gets into a dent in sandstone and changes the chemical properties so it erodes differently in the heat. So it only appears, as far as I know, I'm not aware of any of these, aren't on sea coasts. And they'll make these complicated sort of honeycomb-y kind of things that will then, like, water will flow over them, and so they'll fill with pebbles. And, right, anyway, they do all kinds of odd things. How do you simulate Tifone? There actually are a few papers about simulating Tifone, but eventually you have to have some. The big challenge with things like Tifone is the geometry, because they're all like eating into each other and so on. And so if you really want to simulate something like a Tifone, what do you need to do for that? You need a Delaunay deformable model or something like this. This is a paper that comes out of the image segmentation literature. We talked a little about Delaunay triangulations earlier. This takes us, we don't want to go very far here, but let's start here. We take some points, we take the Delaunay triangulation of them. Okay? We can do this, we talked about Delaunay triangulations work. But if you look at the points, these points sort of look like the outline of a chubby U. And the Delaunay triangular, Delaunay deformable model is a way of saying, okay, each of these triangles is either inside or outside the U. There are none that span the boundary between the U. You can actually prove that this will be the case for certain characteristics of the boundary being well defined. And then if you mark each triangle with being inside or outside, you can then move them at random and you can redo the boundaries. Okay? And so this paper is all about how you do this, how you figure out what the boundary is, how you do with advection, how the centroid, the circumcenters of the triangles tell you things, how you can add additional materials. And then this gets down to how do we use this to do medical imaging and segmenting of models, right? That's their take-home message here. But they also have this, how do we turn a sphere into a couple of toruses? And the nice thing is if you do a model like this, you never have to wonder what happens. It just does the right thing. Geometry is guaranteed because there's tetrahedra that are one model or the other, and it's unambiguous which one they are. And so you'll have breaks and so on that will just work out, and the topology will change, and things can merge. Okay, this is not the only model of doing this. Sometimes people do voxels, just sort of a 3D pixel array. But if you want to do something, something that can do very complicated geometry like this, you need to think about your data model underneath that will allow it to happen before you get too far. Okay. Procedural terrain generation is one of those unusual areas in computer graphics that, as far as I know, the academic community stopped being interested in long before a couple of people that cared a whole lot did. And so there is this tool, just one, I think it's called, yes, TerraGen. I can never remember its website because it isn't TerraGen, but that's all right, Wikipedia knows. Okay, this is like, there was a couple of people that decided they cared a whole lot about terrain. And they just kept studying and making a cooler and cooler tool. And so it does everything that we know how to do about terrain. It does it all. And it also has probably some of the state-of-the-art way of doing clouds. And how, right? And they have procedural ways of generating all kinds of different things, land, sunlight, and so on. The vast majority of the stuff they do, I don't know how it works, because it wasn't published. Some of the early works here and the related works are published, and so we have some ideas about how they're doing it, but this is one of those rare cases in this field where some private industry just did things nobody else did. And so I don't know what they're doing. I can make some educated guesses here and there based on some of the things I know they're using to do it. But there is this whole space that exists, and there is a potential, if you care really much, really a lot about something, of just making it your business and being the last word in that. Yes?
What is like the popularity of such a tool? Is it like widely used?
This tool?
Yeah.
Is it widely used? Yes, asterisk. Terrain is background in almost everything. It's almost never the thing you care the most about. Right? And so, if you really care about getting good procedural terrain, this is the tool. And the other tools that do other things, they typically natively speak Terrigen file formats so that you can do the part that Terrigen's best at, the terrain generation in Terrigen, and import it into whatever they do nicely about having, you know, animated rivers or whatever it is. But it's not a large portion of the graphics market, because if you get a cooler mountain range, what do you do with it? You know, it doesn't become the key of the next great movie. You don't get more ad revenue than other people, right? So it remains somewhat niche. And part of the reason there is one company that just sort of owns it is because there isn't a whole lot of demand to support a huge amount of competition. Do most people know it's around? Probably not, because most people probably never thought about it. But if you search for procedural terrain generation, usually within two clicks you arrive at Terrigen. Sort of no matter where you start. It's just always there. At least this has been my experience. Other questions? Instantly, one of the leaders of this company used to have this great set of graphics tutorials that are no longer online, but the Wayback Machine is your friend. Anyway, yeah. All right. Landscape. I don't remember what this one was. What was this one? Oh, yeah. All right. So, where do we go from all of this? There's a huge amount of information known here. There are active research papers in this area, more in the plants than the terrain, but a fair amount in both. A lot of it is based on let's throw fractals at things because humans aren't used to looking at it enough to know that's not right. We'll get the bumpiness right, we'll get the branchiness right, and people will think it's good. Or we try to understand the physics behind it and simulate the salt eating away at the sandstone or whatever it is. And with those pieces, we can get just about anything we want, although it's arguable that we don't want what we ought to. We really care about making things look like toothpaste and not mayonnaise and fluids. Perhaps we should really care about making things look like, I don't know, loam and not peat in our soil simulations as well. But thus far, there doesn't seem to have been the demand for that. But who knows? At some point, it may become the hip new thing and start showing up in movies where people are tearing up the ground or something, and it will suddenly be important. But for now, it doesn't seem to be. Any parting thoughts about plants or terrain? Okay, we have 3 minutes. Anybody have anything they want to talk about for 3 minutes? Yeah?
I was wondering if there's any areas of graphics that like are sort of like most lucrative.
Areas of computer graphics that are most lucrative. The number of people that do better than an upper middle class lifestyle as a computer programmer is a very small number in every field. So computer graphics are used in some very lucrative fields. Advertisements, particularly. Computer games are I don't know if it's still the case, at least for a while they were making more 3D computer games were making more revenue than movies were. As a gross market. Well, there was some speculation at the time this was a hump, and I didn't actually check to see if it was. There's a lot of money in this space, but most of the people that work there are artists. And most of the people that make business money there are producers, investors. because that's how our economy currently works, right? That said, the computer scientists in that space, like every kind of space, have very stable jobs. Less so, arguably, in computer games than the rest. It turns out there's this subset of the population that like computer games as their children and believe that they need to go into computer games, and since the computer comes first, they then study computer scientists, and then they only want to go into video game industry. It's the only industry that, for many years, actually had more people wanting jobs than there were jobs in computing. And so traditionally, it has had the worst pay scales, the worst working conditions of all of the computing jobs you can find. I'm told that in recent years, that started to turn around, as even they have started to feel the lack of qualified talent, and they've had to start making their conditions better for their employees. But traditionally, since computer graphics was invented in the 80s, this has been the case. That if you go into the gaming industry, you get less benefits in every other part of your life. But does that mean you shouldn't do that? No. Right? It turns out that in general, the less people like their job, the more they get paid. Right? Because you got to get somebody to do the job. And so there's sort of a mixture of if you can find qualified people, if there's a lack of qualified people, pay goes up. And if nobody wants the job, pay goes up. Right? And so a low paying job does not mean a bad job. It may mean a fun job, or it may mean there's too many people that want it. Anyway, I will see you all on Thursday.